RadioInfluence.com. This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
And welcome into this Tuesday, October 30th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. It is trade deadline day in the NFL. We are getting this podcast to you just a tad later in the day. We're going to getting it done before the trade deadline, but been really active morning. Hopefully you've been following us on Twitter at Landry Football for all the latest information. We're going to talk a little bit about trade deadline, a couple of moves that have been made. There are some other things that I have been working on with teams, and we'll see how that transpires the rest of the day. And again, you can follow us in our notebooks on LandryFootball.com for all the latest information, as well as on Twitter at LandryFootball for all the latest information around the trade deadline day. Want to remind you, though, in along with that, the importance of, if you are listening to this podcast, the importance of also joining us at LandryFootball.com. Folks, it's we really want you to be part of our family. You know, we really try to bring you a lot of on-the-surface information about the world of football, college and NFL, here on this podcast. And Scott Seidenberg and I bring you another podcast. As you know, we talk college football and NFL here on this podcast. We have a college football podcast called Rush the Field that we talk to you about, and we bring it to you every Wednesday. But LandryFootball.com is where we can take you inside the film room with greater detail. Break down the college game, the pro game. We've been working along with dealing with the trade deadline information and working out all the information around the college and NFL game. We are breaking down all the film of the previous game and looking ahead to how these matchups are going to take place. Tonight, we've got the unveilings of the first poll rankings of the committee rankings, which are going to be changed drastically over the next week. But we're going to be getting into that, talk a little bit about that, as well as kind of recap what happened this past weekend and how that's going to shape the frame of things. We've got some questions that we want to answer here today in the podcast. A couple of them, remind you that if you've got any questions that you want us addressed here, give us a shout at LandryFootball.com and we'll address it. So, but back to LandryFootball.com is where we take you in depth and inside. And that is really how you can support this podcast and how you can support us here at LandryFootball.com. And all we're trying to do for you is to bring you inside the game from inside the film room from a coaching and scouting perspective. So check us out, will you? We've got great discounts. It's very, very affordable. I mean, you can try it out for a month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year. It's less than a magazine subscription. Less than you pay for a magazine subscription, you can get access to a pro and college scouting department. So a lot of information. The draft, of course, recruiting that's coming up big, and we've got all the latest there. We jump around a lot. We take you inside all the areas that you need to know to be a more knowledgeable football fan, just for your own benefit, just for your fantasy benefit, your gaming benefit, whatever the case may be. That's what we do for you. All right. Want to get into a few things. We've got, obviously, the Browns coaching situation. We've got the Bucs quarterback situation. Got problems in Jacksonville. We've got the coaching move made on assistant staff in Dallas. So we got a lot of things to get to. But we do want to talk a little bit about the trade deadline. As I mentioned, we're going to have possibly some more moves that at least are being worked. We're working on it right now. We'll see how many will take place. Today, so far, we've had a couple of receivers. You've known that there have been a couple of receivers that have been on the market. Demaryius Thomas has been on the market in Denver. He has been traded to the Houston Texans, who lost Will Fuller last Thursday night due to an injury. The Texans are playing well. The Broncos are not. And for a fourth and a seventh round pick, Demaryius Thomas goes and joins a pretty good receiving core in Houston to add to Deshaun Watson. So big, if he can get ready to play this week, ironically, they play the Broncos. So it'll be interesting to see if that makes its way into this coming week schedule or not. Also, Golden Tate on the trade market, on the trade block in Detroit, has been moved to Philadelphia for a third-round pick. People have asked me, hey, it's fun to have these trade deadlines and whatnot. Yes, it's certainly interesting. It's certainly different. It's certainly it's changed a little bit since we've moved the trade deadline back. And obviously, if you have a week three trade deadline, you don't have many people that are willing to give up on the season. Not that the people that are making trades are giving up on the season. They certainly, from a coaching standpoint and a player standpoint, have a lot to play for, their jobs to play for, but let's call it what it is. We're not looking at teams with a great deal of hope to make the playoffs. So you do have a little bit of a baseball effect, maybe a little basketball effect, of buyers and sellers. And we've seen certainly the Giants last week, the Raiders all season. We're seeing Denver. Traded. Now, Detroit is interesting because they traded for Snacks. Harrison traded away Golden Tate. So Detroit has been a buyer and a seller here thus far in the trade market. And we'll see some of that. People have asked me, why are we seeing more of it? Well, because it's later in the season and there's a more definitive line of who are potential players in the run for the playoffs, and as well as I think you're seeing a generation of new GMs. And having been around this league a long time, I'm seeing more and more GMs, some ex-players like an Elway and a John Lynch, that really don't have a background in coaching or scouting. And you have other guys like a Howie Roseman, who's more of a business background. They don't have the confidence, nor have they had a lot of success in the draft, where, you know, they feel confident in many cases and more along the line, more inclined to go out and buy somebody else's player, trade for somebody else's player on a quick fix. Because there's an old saying in scouting. I've worked in both pro personnel and college scouting at the NFL level, and the pro personnel guys have an easier job because the pro personnel guys are just evaluating players that are already in the league. And all you have to do is grade how they've done against the players that you want to see them do it against, NFL players. The real gem and the real skill of scouting is the ability to do it evaluating college players because you're projecting all of those guys. No guy that is ever in college, before they get in the NFL, they've never played pro ball. So everything is a projection. So knowing how to evaluate and having experience of being able to do it over years and years has a tremendous impact on your ability to evaluate. And a lot of these young guys are not really good at it and have made a lot of mistakes and tend to go for the quick fixes. So this is the other thing is just the modern age that we're in. You can't develop and do things like you are supposed to do them. You have to win immediately. And if you're not winning, you have to turn it around immediately, or else everybody is completely impatient. So all of that's led to more activity around this trade situation. Just to give you a little bit of idea of how it works, you go in with the idea, whether you are a team that is out of the playoff race or working your way out of the playoff race or in the playoff race, you tend to look, you've got people on your staff in your pro personnel department that are scouting every team in the league. And you've got a report, a book on every player in the league, how they're doing, their contract, their injury history, time missed, everything. You look and evaluate that up against your roster. And you have personnel meetings every Monday after the game. And so people know, after the coaches have had a chance to grade the film on Mondays, you have a personnel meeting. It's before you begin game planning the next weekend. And you really look, in a personnel standpoint, evaluate, we're not getting enough out of this left guard position. We're not getting enough out of our third safety. We can't run this because we don't have a corner that we can line up in the slot well enough against the players, the receivers, the slot receivers we have in our division. You know, whatever the case may be, and you begin to really pull all that together, evaluate it together, make some decisions together on what you need to do to improve it. If you're a team that's pretty good, you've got a chance. There's an opportunity out there to perhaps get a player. You survey every option. You call teams. You see who might be available. You certainly, with contacts around the league, you have an idea who might be willing to move on from a player. You have to do your homework. Why do they want to get rid of him? Is he a problem in the locker room? Is he an underachiever? Does he have injury issues? Is it just a contractual issue? If it's a contractual issue, can we afford to sign him at the end of the year? Do we want to sign him now and rent him for the rest of the year and just run the risk that we won't be able to sign him at the end of the year? Do we want to give up a third-round pick for that? Maybe you do. Maybe you don't. Maybe you like the player, but you think that in order to trade for him, you would want to get him signed up long-term before you make that move. Are you willing to make that commitment long-term? How old is he? Is he 30? Is he 31? Do you want to commit a three-year deal to him? You think he's worth it? All these things have to be factored in. So you're evaluating a player that's going to be a fit for you or not a fit for you, a player that's going to make some sense financially, short-term and long-term, and what can he bring to you this year? Every situation's a little different. There's some teams that are in a win-now mode. There's some teams that can make a run this year, compete for a Super Bowl. They may be a little bit more aggressive. And if they're a team that maybe it's got an aging team, maybe a team that's, you know, a little older, that the chances of having a lot of years left in that run may not be there. You might be more aggressive then. You do that, then when you're in the rebuild mode, then you're obviously in a bad way when you lose that guy and you've lost all your picks. There again, acquiring picks are great. They're great. For somebody like me, a personnel guy that's been fortunate enough to be a part of building three separate Super Bowl rosters with three different organizations, that's been really the main staple, is having draft picks and utilizing them well. But that's the key. Can you draft well? Do you know how to draft? Do you know how to identify players? Do you know how to build a team? Or do you just collect talent and you don't have a really good plan in place? Everybody's got a plan. Some people have good plans. Some people have bad plans. Everybody's got a plan. So you look through all of that, through the prism of all of that, and you try to make these decisions, make a lot of calls, and then you try to work it. And if you feel you go in with the idea of, okay, what would be willing to give up? Now, at this stage, you can't make decisions. I know people will say this. Well, is this guy better than a guy we could get in the second round this year? No, you can't really go that way. I got to tell you. You know, people who think that you can do that, it's not that easy. Okay, because you really don't know who's going to be there in the second round. You're not complete through that process. However, if you feel like that there's really good depth at, let's say, receiver, you like the receiving group, the early returns, or that you really like what's going to be on the board in the draft at receiver, do you want to spend that money on a draft pick that you're going to lose out to get a veteran guy? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But if you do, can he take you beyond 1 year? As I said, is he just a rental player? If you trade for him, he's not all that productive. You still might be able to sign him. But remember, a player that goes to market is going to generally receive a little bit more money than he's worth because he's going to market and he's going to have multiple teams looking at him. So these are all things that take place on the trade leading up to the trade deadline. Speaking of some decisions that were made, obviously the Cleveland Browns made a decision to fire Hugh Jackson, fire as their head coach, fire Todd Haley as their offensive coordinator. It was coming. It was coming for a while. Let's go back to a year ago. And I told members of the Cleveland media and talk shows in that area that when they were making that move and they hired John Dorsey and decided to give up on that experiment of the money ball, the feeling all along from ownership, right or wrong, was that Hugh Jackson didn't have a real opportunity with that experiment of basically rebuilding. So when he hired the new general manager, John Dorsey, it was with the idea that Hugh Jackson was going to be the coach. He felt, as an owner, that he was going to give him the opportunity to coach and see what he could do. It was a fair thing. And for someone that's made poor decisions as an owner, and you can say this was another poor decision, but I will say this, it was a fair decision for Hugh. Hugh Jackson had every opportunity to make this work. Now, I defended Hugh Jackson to some degree when this whole front office experiment failed and they may have had all these picks and they had no players. I don't think Hugh did a great job coaching last year. Of course not. I think they probably could have won a game or two. Not more than that. It's a bad roster. But you didn't do a very good job. You had an opportunity, and I thought there were some improvements made. He went out. He's going to be an overseer of the coaching staff. Hired a strong coordinator in Todd Haley. And off they go. Let him run the offense. As the offense struggled, here's where the problem began to take place. Yes, it always stems from you don't play well. Your record, how well you play, that affects the attitude, that affects the morale, that affects the direction. Listen, I think it was not a great thing for the Browns, but it was maybe a good thing for fans to see. Hard Knocks. What you see on Hard Knocks is a lot of what people like myself see on the inside that people on the outside don't ever see. And that was a lot of dysfunction. You didn't need a lot of TV viewing to see that Todd Haley was arrogant. Todd Haley was a headstrong. Hugh Jackson kept telling everybody, I'm the head coach, I'm this and that. It was almost like he was trying to convince people. It was dysfunctional from the get-go. Now, if you get out and win, that stuff goes away real quick. That dysfunction is, hey, they're harder on each other. They hold each other accountable. That's good stuff then, right? You lose, becomes dysfunctional. Because then it becomes where you're not winning. And then Hugh started, I think, to become a weak head coach, a weaker head coach, and completely weak. And when he started to, I'm the head coach, I'm going to jump in there and fix it. And then kind of back off. And then all of a sudden there's this veiled pointing of the fingers towards someone else. In other words, I'm going to jump in there and fix it. Not my fault. I got this guy doing it. No. You're the head coach. And then, of course, Todd Haley takes offense to it, and he has his shots and his sources that he uses in the media, and boom, and then you got the full-fledged dysfunction. Well, then that was the final straw for ownership and management, John Dorsey, that, you know, listen, this would have been something that if Hugh had handled better, he probably would have gotten the rest of the year, and they probably would have fired Todd Haley. If Todd had handled it better, they probably, you know, would have maybe moved in a different direction and make a move there. But reality came down to a complete dysfunctional view of an operation, leadership-wise. Got a young quarterback that's kind of in the middle, and that's when it really started to fall apart. Now, the feeling was inside John Dorsey felt like, I think when he got the job, he would have liked to have brought in this guy. He understood that, listen, he was out of work, and for him to get a job, this was the job and this was the conditions. But he knew that he was going to have a chance, and it's not a bad situation, folks, to come in as a GM, put together your scouting structure, front office structure together, let the coaches do their job, observe that, see what works, see what doesn't work, and then modify it from there. Folks, it's not a bad thing when you think about it. I know it is commonplace to say the Browns have always sucked, they always will suck. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But let me just say this, and this is not good for the fans, because the fans, they want to see something positive. Browns fans have been very patient. It's been bad regime after bad regime after bad regime after bad regime. But I can tell you there's a chance, and we'll see what John Dorsey can do with this, leading this, and perhaps convincing the owner to make the right decisions on a head coach. Because now they've got time to do it. They've got time to evaluate and see where things lay. Where do they want to go? How do they want to frame this team? And really, at this point, here's what it does to the players. It tells the players, okay, now you're on the hook now. We're going to see who's going to play, who's going to be a Brown, and who's not from here on out. And I think those things are going to be important. Greg Williams will do some things that are different, maybe better, maybe not. But they're going to be different. They're going to be hard-edged. That's him. We'll see how it responds. Where do they go from here? Well, let me just say this. In doing a lot of coaching search work, the NFL and college, you got to understand and you got to figure out what it is you want. And people think it's really easy to just go hire this guy. People look at names that they're familiar with, that they hear about, that they read about, without any really knowledge of the person or his skills as a coach. They just know the record. They don't know what he really did or didn't do. That's why certain people get jobs and are not successful, not as good as you thought or better than you thought, because you don't know who really does what inside an organization unless you work in the organization and you work in the business. And this is where I've, you know, had some success in my consulting work, is knowing who does what, who's responsible for what. Those things are really important to know. So I get it. People are going to have their favorites and who they think this or that. Let me say this, too. It is a lot about fits. There are a lot of people that are qualified. Some people can fit in any situation and are proven in any situation. But most people fall into the category of whether they fit or not. Some people, personality fits. Some philosophical fits. Some don't. You've got to look at it. As a GM, you've built a roster. You have an idea of what you want to be, how you want to be. Do you want to come in and bring somebody that's going to want to tear all the good things apart? Throw the baby out with the bathwater? No, you want to find somebody that's going to come in and build upon what you have, do it better, and maybe add some things that needed to be added. That's what you really want to do. I think stability is important, but stability comes after you make the right hire. You know, it's a chicken egg thing. I mean, in order to have stability, you got to have the right hire in the first place. If you don't make the right hire, then and you end up in a bad situation, what must be done eventually must be done immediately. And not making that change is akin to keeping a carton of spoiled milk in your refrigerator thinking it's going to get better in a week. It only gets worse. You have to get rid of it and move on. But once you have the right person in place and you feel like you do, it must be, it is really important and it's essential that you allow that to grow in the proper manner so that it has deep roots and will sustain both tough times and good times, which we all are going to have. So it's not easy to make a hire and it's not easy to identify. Yeah, you can throw some names out and some are obvious. Let me say this, in this Browns situation, we look at certainly some talent on defense, some improvement on defense, certainly not without flaws, but an improving unit. On offense, again, a couple of pieces here or there, certainly young quarterback, need more weapons, but again, need better direction. There are a couple of ways you can go. There's no doubt that the singular focus thing is to find somebody that can groom, train Baker Mayfield and take his game to the highest level. That's the most important thing in this league, in a quarterback-driven league. Find the right guy. You can go and get a defensive coach as a head coach and hire the bright young coordinator. There's nothing wrong with that except this. In this league, the trend is finding that great teacher of quarterbacks, developer of quarterbacks. You know, the Sean McVays is thrown out now. He's the hot guy. So you can go out and find a young coordinator that's maybe a year or so away. If he has success for you, and you hope he does, somebody's going to pick him off within 2 years to be their head coach. Which is why I think if you can find that right guy, and it's not a given, but if you find that right guy, pluck that guy, that quarterback whisperer, to be your head coach. Because then he's yours until you don't want him to be yours. And I think that that's something that the Browns will likely look at. We'll get into more details about who that could be. There are a lot of people. There are a lot of things we'll be talking about on LandryFootball.com and breakdowns and right here on this podcast. There are a lot of bright young coaches that could fill a leadership role. And some you've probably heard of and know. Some you probably haven't. Some you probably heard of that you don't think that's going to be available, but might be. We'll get into all that in the days and weeks to come. In Tampa, and it's gotten really bad, worse, in fact, at the quarterback position. Jameis Winston, an awful performance. As I said, when Jameis came out of Florida State, he's never been one that processes information well, and he forces the football. You can teach that out of him to some degree. You know, what's the capacity to learn? What's the willingness to learn? I think Jameis actually works pretty hard. But Jameis is a forcer. He will force it into a spot. And, you know, because he's someone that, you know, he talks a lot and he says a lot of the right things, Jameis is a guy that is not necessarily what you think he is. Publicly, he comes across a little bit better than he does privately, and that he does kind of what he wants to do. And probably needed a stronger coach to probably break him and rebuild him. I think that guys like Jameis, though, normally, and I go back to him since high school, people have enabled him. So he's someone that feels that he's entitled and that no one's going to tell him what to do, that he's going to do it his way. And, you know, he'll, again, say things publicly that will curry favor. But the reality is the results are the same because the process of which he takes are the same. He's not a high character individual, and high character individuals don't normally do the right things when people are not looking. In terms of preparation, in terms of making decisions, that's not what he does well, on or off the field. The Bucs are gone with Ryan Fitzpatrick this week. We'll see how it goes. Listen, we know what Ryan Fitzpatrick is. He's a relief pitcher. He's a guy that can bring a spark off the bench. But the longer he plays, the more he's limited. We know that Jameis has more ability to be a starter, but at this stage, if he hasn't developed, he's probably not going to. And for the Buccaneers, they're dealing with an option, and this decision is tied to long-range money, which I think it's absolutely foolish if the Bucs go forward with him. I think there'll be massive changes. I think there'll be a new quarterback. I think there'll be a new head coach. I think there'll be a new general manager in Tampa. I think they'll have all of that. The reason why they've stuck with Jameis Winston this long and have erred in doing that is the same reason it happens in most places. The guy that is ultimately responsible is the guy responsible for him being there. So the people that stood on the table and did not worry at all about the off-the-field concerns, character issues, are the ones that are still in his corner. Why? Because their job is on the line. But now it's gotten so bad to where I don't know if they can continue to fight through the mistakes that he made. So this is going to be, as I said, even with the quick start of the Bucs, a long season. And one is what's going to end badly, I think, for a lot of people in the organization. In Jacksonville, I think the lack of leadership shows up big time. In you know, the whole going out and guys getting arrested and charges being dropped and what have you, that's one issue. But it's reflective of the fact that you don't have good leadership. What are you doing going out that late, not being focused? Now, you'll hear the jive talkers, the Deion Sanders, people like that say, it ain't no problem. Maybe do that. No. It is a problem. You don't know it's a problem because you're from a different world and you've never coached and you've never been in that situation to where if you don't have good leadership, if you don't have accountability, it's the idea that if you're out that late, you're out focusing on other things, you're not focused on where it should be. You're just along for the ride, along for the paycheck, and the trappings that playing in pro football get you, and not as concerned about being a great football player. So I think there's some issues there, and we know the biggest problem on the field is the offense and the lack thereof and the lack of a passing game, mainly due to the lack of a running game. They can't run play action now. Can't run the football. Big problems here. It's interesting to see as kind of go through the week, you see Seattle starting to play well. Washington seems to be doing as good a job as anybody in the NFC East of managing what they have. Good defense, running game. Alex Smith making plays. Pittsburgh clearly the team to beat in the AFC North. I tell you, Carolina with Norv Turner as play calling and Ron Rivera as a head coach, this team is a physically and mentally tough team, And North Turner is doing a great job. They're a legitimate threat and are going to stay right on the heels of the Saints all year long. And it'll likely come down to those two games. They haven't played yet this year. That will be as big as anything. The Rams continue to find ways to win. Big win for the Saints against Minnesota. Games get bigger, right? Saints and the Rams play this week in the Superdome. Big because this is where the Saints, if they are able to win, can get the Rams a loss and basically tie the Rams for the best record in the NFC. I don't expect the Saints and the Rams to go 15-1, but at least would tie in terms of the ability to control your fate a little bit in terms of home field advantage. Two things you want, really. First thing you want to do is win your division, then you want to win a bye, then you want to get home field advantage. You know, the Rams have pretty much got the division wrapped up. So the division is pretty much a fait accompli. I think if they were to stumble, I think Seattle could stay in that race. I felt like they're a wild card team and a quasi-division contender if the Rams come back to earth. The Saints are going to be in a race all year long with Carolina, it does appear. Some big games this weekend we're going to get into. Again, the Rams, New Orleans, the Chargers, Seattle, Green Bay, New England, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Detroit, Minnesota. Kind of headline them a bit. All right, I want to get into some college issues, but I want to answer some questions first. Jacob asks, I freely admit that question play calling on a team that just scored 42 points is insane. However, the Texans ran the ball on every first down. In the second half, the Dolphins linebackers were running into the gaps on first down with no regard for the possibility of a pass. Yes, was Bum Phillips calling the first down plays, or was Watson not allowed to audible? Bum Phillips is no longer with us, of course. We know Jacob was kidding. He also wants to know which teams have improved the most at the start of the season. Well, I can tell you that Pittsburgh's gotten better, but the Houston Texans have improved the most. I think Seattle's improved a lot. I think New England has improved. Those jump out at me as the teams that have improved the most, Jacob. Play calling. First down, second down, whatever the case may be. You're talking about the running into the gap. So first of all, there are different types of run plays. Okay, you can run the football, but you can run out of different formations. You can run in a what looks to be a play action run that's really more of a run action where you've got the opportunity to run the football. You know, when you talk about linebackers running into the gaps, well, a lot of that has to do with how you set it up formation-wise and how you get in people into different looks and they react to what you're doing. So a lot of it is a reaction to what you're doing. But if you go back and look, you do have to look at play calling from a what is the front, what is the coverage, and what are you trying to do? There's no question that from a play calling standpoint, you want to establish certain things. And when you get a lead, a lot of times you want to be able to run the football. Running the football is a methodology. It's more than just a play call. It's an establishment of the line of scrimmage. You mentioned it. Yeah, on early down, they ran a lot. They ran a lot. Now, the question is maybe there was an opportunity here or there to be able to pull the ball, run a play action on first down, and get them beat. But when you've got enough points, you tend to be a little bit more conservative because one of the things that you want to do is play the clock to your favor. When you've got a lead, your opponent then as much is the clock as it is your opponent. So I get it. I understand the frustration in a general sense, but you want to make sure that you're smart about what you want to do and when you want to do it. But your point's well taken. You ask, is Watson not allowed to audible? Well, there's an audible signal there, but it has to be the right look to check out of, and obviously there wasn't in those situations. I watched the game, but breaking down the tape, I can tell you that the linebackers weren't lined up in the loaded front on every one of those downs. Now, running into the gaps post-snap is different than their pre-snap alignment. So keep in mind, too, that while it may look like because the run wasn't successful that they're running into a brick wall, that's not necessarily how they were aligned going into it. Richard asks, Jameis Winston threw four picks on Sunday, got benched. Is it time for the Bucs to move on from Jameis Winston? Really went into that Richard, obviously, if you heard the early part of that, it absolutely is. I think it's been time. I think that the issue, though, the rest of the way is going to be how do they manage it? They don't want to get on the hook for, you know, here's the issue that you don't want to get into. And this is the one thing you got to look at if you're Tampa. Do you want to play Winston, or have you given up on him? Has everyone given up on him in the organization? The fan base can say what they want. The media can say what they want. Has everybody given up on him in the administration? If they have, then you don't want to play him and get him hurt, and now you're dealing with an injury settlement and issues. That's not a good situation. If you haven't given up on him and you feel like you can revive him, that's where the decision to try to play him comes in. That's not me, but again, you have to look at it from their standpoint, what they're thinking. What's your assessment of John Harbaugh as a coach? John's been a really good coach. His teams have been good on defense, good on special teams. He's made some changes on offense in the past. I think he's done a really solid job. Is it outstanding? No. I mean, look, they've won a Super Bowl. Are they happy right now with a little bit of the run lately? No, I don't think anybody is. Unless you're winning every year, you're not happy. But I think the guy's done a very good job. I do think there's some pressure on him. I do think Steve Bisciotti's really good owner and has been real patient, wants to see more. So that answers those questions. Also have one more question about the play call sheets that these coaches have. Some of them have larger sizes than others. Is that an indication of bigger playbook? Why some have bigger sheets? Why some don't have them? Why does some coach have them? Why they don't? Okay. First of all, why do some coaches have them as head coaches and don't? Well, some head coaches are the play callers on offense. And this is in college and the NFL, folks. Some are the play callers on offense. Some are not. Some will have the play call sheet to listen to the play call and to make notes. Some do not and allow it someone else to do that. That's why some have it and some don't. Defensively, kind of the same thing. The same thing applies whether they have them or don't, depending on whether they call the defense and have the plays in front of them or whether they just have it to reference who is doing it and making notes accordingly. Now, the size of them. Well, first of all, give you an idea how your play call sheets are made. You go in through a game plan each week where you go in and break down your opponent. And let's just take an offensive play call sheet. It's the same thing applies to the defense. But offensively, you're breaking down an opponent's defense. What do they do? And what's your best way, the things that you do in your scheme that you think can work best against them? Then you go in with a broad idea all week of what you want to run. And you go through practices. And each day is different things that you're working on. But it's a larger pool of things you're working on. And as you practice it, you then discover, based upon how well your team executes it, what's good, what's not good in practice. Meaning, you know, if you're struggling to run a certain play, a certain route out of a certain personnel grouping, or you're having trouble to block a certain thing, for whatever reason, you might want to take that out of your game plan. That's what practice is for. Based upon your everyday practice in every period, you are making notes. And then when you go back and look at the film, you decide as a staff, we need to do more of this and less of that. And you take things out of the plan. Occasionally, you'll add a couple of things in that you think might be better. And then you work on that the rest of the week. By the end of the week, you've accumulated what you think is going to work best against the opponent for that week. You even, in the case of the coordinator, head coach, whoever the one is calling the plays, meet with the quarterback. What are you comfortable with? Meet with your receivers. What are you more comfortable with? I feel good about this or that. I don't feel as comfortable about that. That's where the game plan comes in. Then what you have is that game plan, that call sheet, is put in for that week. But everything is put in according to situations. So when you see that call sheet that you're looking at, that's not You know, all the little that's not the amount of plays on it. It's the plays in various situations. So you go through every situation. First and 10. These are our best runs. These are our best passes. This is our best formation, our best personnel group. These are our best plays that fit against this look. So you have, in essence, a lot of the same plays, but organized and categorized differently and ranked differently, if you will, depending on how you think they're going to work based upon the game plan you set up for this week. So you have a lot of the same plays in the personnel groupings, but it'll be done and organized situationally based upon against this look and this down and distance and this position on the field, this time left in the game, so on and so forth. So you look and glance to all the situations. It's like having a menu, if you will, of plays organized by categories. And that really is what makes up the length of the size of the play call sheet, is you got to go through every situation and you got to prepare for that. Now, as the game goes along, you make notations on it that will help you determine, we need to go back to that. This is not working really good. We're really having a hard time blocking the three technique. So this is not going to work. This worked all week in practice, but it is not working now. We need to do less of this, and we need to do more of that. And you make those notations, and you go forward. The other thing that determines the size of it is, very simply, that we can all relate to, is the size of the print. You know, you see some of them have reading glasses. Some of them just make larger print because it's the same stuff, but sometimes you got to make the print on the font a lot bigger. It's done inside a computer, and then it is, again, printed out based upon categories, and then it's kind of put together like a collage, if you will, organized on a bigger sheet of paper in the way you want, and then it's put into that machine that everybody has to make it, you know, has the plastic on it to where it protects it, protective shield on it. And you normally like to do that because if it rains or just if you got a player that's sweating or spilling water on it, it's easy to wipe off and it doesn't smear the print on it and it doesn't smear what you make note of. Now, you got to have a special type of pen to make notes on those things and for it to stay, a particular type of Sharpie that will stay on it. Some that I know, like Sean Payton, for example, doesn't do the covered. He has that little, you know, thin little wafer board, if you will, and it's not covered. And it's not as protected. He's got a little bit of a shield on it, but not as protected. But, you know, he's in the dome a lot, and he plays in Atlanta. And so he's in those situations, he's not as reliant upon having it covered because he doesn't have to deal with the element of weather, at least on home games. So I hope that answers your question about play call sheets and play call boards. All right, take a look around college football. Things that jumped out at me last week is, A, the improvement of West Virginia offensively. Going to be interesting to see against this Texas defense. Texas, really tough go last week in Oklahoma State and Stillwater. Is this going to be a Texas team that's going to respond when they're down? That's what Texas does under Tom Herman, right? That's what Herman does. When you count him out, that's when he comes back and he plays well in big games. You start to get high on them, they fall apart. Going to be interesting to see in the Big 12 there. USC is progressively getting worse, and people ask me, what is the issue there? It is line play. They don't have war daddies on the offensive and defensive line that looks like USC-type guys. They fired Neil Calloway as offensive line coach. They've taken the play calling away from T. Martin. Clay Helton's under a lot of pressure. I think the biggest thing that's going to get him is, look at that stadium. There's nobody in that stadium watching them last week. They got a real problem that they've got to figure that out. Miami's got a problem. Saw them on Friday night. You knew in the red bandana game, BC would be up playing well. This BC team is really good. They're physical. They can rush the passer. They can defend the run. They can run the football. Really good team. We talked about the trouble that Purdue might have on the road against Michigan State, didn't we? Michigan State, tough, well-coached. Can you handle Prosperity? tough go of it. Northwestern, we thought they would play well at home against Wisconsin. Boy, they did more than play well. They pounded Wisconsin. Really, really impressive. A lot of credit to Georgia. Really answered the call. I thought they had a much better game plan than they did against LSU. I thought they executed much better. I thought they played a lot tougher, played in an atmosphere that was a little bit more favorable. And they didn't try to throw their way out of it. They tried to be more focused on running the football and controlling the game that way was big, was the key. Florida played well. You can see the improvement of Florida. Very, very impressed with them. They fell a little short. Penn State, give them a lot of credit. A lot of athletes. They played well, did a good job against Iowa. Oklahoma, folks, is getting better and better. And I warn you, that's the team that I would put if I'm ranking the best teams on film. Now, this is probably not, it's not how it's going to come out tonight when the initial rankings come out, but I would put Oklahoma 4. They beat LSU. They beat Michigan. I think they beat this Georgia team. They look, you can score on them, but man, are they good. They'll score on anybody. I'd put them 4. Really good looking team. Tough win by Kentucky. Tough loss for Missouri. Sets up a big time game. We're going to get into that game a little bit this week. A lot this week. Kentucky, Georgia on LandryFootball.com. We'll talk about it on Thursday. Can Kentucky get enough offense? We'll talk a little bit about how this matchup could play out. Impressed on how Mississippi State responded. You know, just when you want to anoint people and A&M's not going to lose and they're really good, maybe they're the best team in the West, Mississippi State takes care of business at home. Got to be impressed by what Washington State did, handling their business on the road and taking care of Stanford. Notre Dame takes care of business against Navy. We talked a little bit about Oklahoma State against Texas. We're going to get into all these breakdowns. We've got, by the way, the film room breakdowns have started. We've got that a number of them up on LandryFootball.com. We'll finish them up tonight and tomorrow to where we'll have all the film room breakdowns of the Power 5 schools, get ready for this weekend's action, kind of recap what happened last week and look ahead towards this week and the personnel matchups, everything from draft prospects to personnel matchups to strategy. We're going to get you focused and obviously have all the game previews this week as well. So looks more and more like the Pac-12 is going to be out. I don't think Washington State's going to run the table. And if they do, they're going to need a whole lot of help to be a player. The Big 12 is going to be interesting. We're going to learn a lot. Now, let me warn you, as you watch the rankings tonight, don't pay attention about who's where or what's – it's not going to matter because this weekend, more than any weekend, is going to change the course of how those initial rankings are going to be because we're going to – Georgia, Kentucky, LSU, Alabama, Penn State and Michigan, West Virginia, Texas. That's going to blow up all the standings that you're going to see tonight. So don't get locked into, don't get excited, don't get agitated based upon how the rankings are tonight because they're going to be quite a bit different. And we're going to break that down for you on Thursday, and we're also going to talk on the Rush the Field podcast on Wednesday for you as well. So be sure to check those out. Remind you again, as we'll get ready and reconvene on Thursday, we'll be breaking, we'll be talking about some of these games. Obviously, the full breakdowns are LandryFootball.com, and we'll be touching base on any latest developments on trade deadline information that will take place today. We'll have that and discuss it on LandryFootball.com, but certainly here on the Landry Football Podcast on Thursday. Break down all the big college games. Focus in on that on Thursday as well. A lot to cover. Remind you that if you've got any questions, send them to us. We'll address them right here at LandryFootball.com. Check out LandryFootball.com. Become a member today. Take advantage of it. We're still offering 50% to help the victims out of the floods. We appreciate you supporting us and supporting them. That makes this podcast possible. So we appreciate your support. We look forward to talking to you again on Thursday, and we'll see you on LandryFootball.com for all the breakdowns. Talk to you next time, everybody.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence. This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
Don't know what's happening in Jameis Winston's life, but if you're looking through his mask, it sure looked like he didn't want to be there. It looks like he looks like a golfer who's lost his swing. And you don't want to be in front of everybody, and that's exactly where he is. Dirk Cutter has not come out and said anything about the starter for next game. I don't know how, with the right mind, he can put Jameis Winston back out there as a starter unless the Glazers are mandating it. That's the only way. And if it's to that point, well, Dirk Cutter should ask to be fired, because you can't look at Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson and O.J. Howard and tell them that the best chance to win is Jameis Winston, because he's not.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.